The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
There's a kind of a joke about Buddhists that all they ever do is talk about practice. Practice, practice, practice. And the joke is, well, when's the performance? Well, the practice and the performance aren't different from each other. The performance is the practice. And in that regard, I think the joke depends on, practicing, like a musical instrument for eventually you get to Carnegie Hall. But I prefer to think of the word practice in the way we use it for a medical practice. I'm not sure why we use the word practice for medical practice, but they're not going to practice on me. For me, it's the performance. I want to know that they've already been trained. And it's a caring for someone. Ideally, medical practice is a caring for someone, that where the actual performance and the caring and the practice all come together. So in that same way, I think of Buddhist practice as being an activity of, that the performance is right there in terms of it's not necessarily something we're doing far in the future, but it's the caring right now for the situation right now that's really the heart of what we're doing in Buddhism. And so it's an activity. I like to think of it as an activity of caring for ourselves, caring for others. It's an activity of practicing. And it might be interesting to look at five different abilities that we all have, capacities we all have, that come into play in all activities that we do, and then see how it plays out in meditation practice. So, I think in pretty much every activity we do, these five come into play in different strengths, different ways, and sometimes they're too much of it, sometimes too little of some of these qualities, some of these capacities, but they have to come into play. And so take something as simple as washing the dishes. First, there has to be some degree of confidence that it makes sense to wash the dishes and that you can do it. Because if you had no confidence that, that you can do it, you probably wouldn't even get to the sink. And it's such a simple thing that we don't think that confidence is an issue, but there's kind of, we have plenty of confidence that it's invisible. I can do the dishes. My poor 12-year-old son had to wash the morning pots at the family camp we were at last week. And he didn't quite have the confidence. But he did it. And so he had another capacity, which was the effort. He had to make effort to do it. So even though he didn't have the confidence, he was stuck. He was stuck. It was just that he was required to be there. So he just did it anyway. So the effort was there. And he made the effort. We had to persist. And sometimes it took a long time to get through the task, but he persisted. And then he had to be present for the activity. And it was a little bit of a challenge because he did it with his best friend. And so there was a lot of, other things that was easily going to happen, like chatting and talking, and what do you have on your iPod? And then there had to be some focus, stay focused on the job, not just be present, but really stay focused on that job. And then they had to have some discernment, some understanding, wise understanding about what was going on there. There were sharp knives, and they had to make sure the sharp knives weren't dropped into all the sudsy water, that they'd grab it. And there was a delicate pots, delicate, glassware and stuff, and you don't just put it all on the bottom of the big stainless steel sink and then put all the heavy pots on top of that. And there has to be some understanding of what you're doing and impact. And so these five things had to be somehow relevant for the situation. There had to be some confidence. There had to be some effort and applied. There had to be some presence for the activity. There had to be some focusing on the activity. And there had to be some discernment, some understanding of what you were doing and the impact, the consequences of different choices you had. Take something a little more complicated. You know, today I had to have a difficult conversation with someone. It was kind of like mediating between two people. But it was a difficult conversation. It was difficult enough that it occurred to me, maybe I can email them instead. And then since I'm leaving town tomorrow for 2 weeks almost, I thought, well, that gives me an excuse not to call the person at all. I can just kind of, you know, I was really busy last day before I left. You know how it is preparing for vacation. And so I just couldn't you know, call you. And so I thought I had an easy excuse. That thought went through my mind. But I had confidence that I could have this conversation that needed to be had. And more important, I had confidence it was really important to have this conversation, the value of it. And then I had to make the effort. And when I first was going to set myself to make the phone call, there was a little kind of mountain to climb. I'm not so sure. But I had to kind of stay at it and apply myself and make the effort. And then I had to be very present for the conversation. This was a conversation that was delicate, was, you know, difficult to do. And so I could say very present, really, not present kind of just generically, but be very attentive to the nuances of the tones of the voice and the words and the different things, and very present for how I was feeling, the reactions I had, so I could stay wise. And I had to be there, the presence. And then I had to keep a focus. Because it was a difficult conversation, in order to track really well what's going on, I had to really stay concentrated on what was going on. If I had the conversation and while I was on the phone did my email, it probably wouldn't have worked. So I had to keep the focus. And then I had to be very discerning. I had to kind of take in all the cues I was getting, and I had to figure out what needed to be said and how to say it. I had to be discerning about my feelings, my reactions. I had to stay calm. I had to kind of negotiate my inner landscape. I had to negotiate the outer landscape of the conversation, the situation. And a lot of choices had to be made, and those choices involved my best understanding that I could at the time. So these are five things that in Buddhism is called the five faculties, the five capacities we all have. And usually in English, these five are called this. They're called faith, effort, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. I like the words, instead of those usual ones, I like the words confidence. I like effort is fine, though persistence is also a good alternative. Mindfulness I like to use. Concentration I like to use. Especially if we remember that almost synonymous with concentration is calm, to be calm in the situation. And then the fifth one, I prefer discernment to wisdom. Because wisdom has the connotation, I don't know, at least to me, that's kind of like a done deal. You're wise. Either wise or you're not. And you carry your wisdom with you. But discernment is an activity where you're searching out for the right understanding. You're discerning. You're separating out. You're looking at the particular situation and how it is and teasing apart the different choices you have and then being wise about those choices. So these five things are called the five faculties. It's interesting that the Buddhist word for faculties here is called indriya, and it comes from the word indra, which is Indra was back in the ancient India one of the great controlling gods, and the great one word for the great almighty in the great Indian pantheon of gods. So they want the god who can control things, the weather and all kinds of stuff, whatever. And so there's this nice shift, seems to be a nice shift in Buddhism, that to take this word for the controlling god of the universe, and turn it around and call it how we control ourselves, how we take responsibility for ourselves. And there's a tendency in Buddhism to really turn away from this pointing to external deities, forces, whatever, for our freedom and our peace, to really understand our role and our responsibility, our practice, our performance in finding our way through this life, through practice, through the path. And so these five indriyas, these five faculties or controlling faculties, we all have them. It isn't like we're importing from India these things, that they're foreign, exotic. We all have them, but the idea is to understand that we have them and understand how they come into play so we can use them to support us in our Buddhist practice, support us in meditation practice, for example. So the first one, as I said, it's often called faith when it's translated into English. I like the word confidence. But faith is also a good word because of how strong the word is in terms of some heartfelt sense of alignment with some values, some sense of purpose, some goal, some understanding of life. We use the word for religious faith, for example. We have a faith, which usually means you have a religion. And so the word faith, you know, has something, for many people, has a much deeper resonance in the heart than the word confidence, which, you know, maybe seems a little bit too analytical or kind of surface. Just have confidence, kind of like having strength. Though some people resist the word faith because it is associated with religion. And they were trying to get away from religion when they came to Buddhism. And so, you know, and usually the word faith implies maybe some kind of, you have to believe in some, a tenet, a creed that maybe you're not sure about. That's not what's happening in Buddhism. But so the idea of confidence, I think to me, works as a very good alternative. Now, in looking at confidence or faith, we always have faith in something. And we always give our confidence to something. And the question is not what do you have, you know, are you going to have faith or are you going to have confidence? The question is, what do you have confidence in? What do you have faith in? Too many people have a lot of faith in their neurosis and a lot of confidence in it. Some people have a lot of confidence in their imaginary futures. And so they put a lot of, people have a lot of confidence in their fear. Their fear, their anxiety. Their anxiety is really important. And so they kind of, and you see, you know, they don't talk about faith in their anxiety, but from all practical terms, they spend as much time being completely devoted to looking at, focusing on, reviewing, polishing their anxiety as a Buddhist contemplative would do or a Christian monk would do, you know, thinking about God, or Christian or Buddhist contemplative doesn't think about God, but think, you know, doing their Dharma practice. It's really phenomenal how much time we spend, you know, focused in our preoccupations. Some people have a lot of faith in desire. And so they spend a lot of time, their mind, if you track what your mind does, it's as if you have a lot of confidence that pursuing, thinking, imagining your desires is going to be valuable for you, whatever your desires might be. Some people have a lot of confidence and faith in hate. And because otherwise, why would they spend so much time doing it? Some part of us, at least, even if we don't think it's not good, are aversions. Some people have a lot of confidence in money, and their focus is on money. Or some people have a lot of confidence in work and advancement there. You know, you get the point. People have always something that the mind is, whatever the mind is preoccupied in, it's preoccupied because it has confidence in something. It's kind of maybe kind of a negative confidence in a sense. So, are there useful and unuseful places to place our confidence, to place our faith? And Buddhism teaches that if you want to become free of your suffering, to experience the kind of liberation that comes from not clinging and grasping, then it's useful to have confidence that it's possible to become free. If you don't have confidence that you can become free of suffering, confidence you can become free of what constricts and tightens the heart, then why would you pursue a practice Why would you perform this wonderful performance we do here? There has to be some confidence there. And there has to be some confidence that you can do it. Not only confidence is worthwhile and it can be done, but that in theory, but that the confidence or support or faith, I can do it. This is something that's possible for me. And so to reflect, you know, where is my confidence go? What do I have faith in? And can I have faith in what Buddhism is teaching enough so I can engage in the practice? Because a practice requires confidence. There's no way around it. Now, we're not talking about faith in Buddhism in some abstract metaphysical thing. We're talking about faith in something very practical. And I think the most practical and the most kind of foundational and radical teaching that Buddhism has to teach, it's very radical, it's very revolutionary, it's extremely profound, is something that's taught at grade school level when people are told about Buddhism in grade school. There are four noble truths. There is suffering, there's a cause of suffering, it's possible to end suffering, and there's a path to end it. And there has to be some confidence, if you want to end suffering, there has to be some confidence in that path and in that understanding of the Four Noble Truths. Because otherwise, it doesn't make any sense. Why would you, you know, the whole path to freedom doesn't make any sense unless you understand the cause, understand how that cause can be taken away or settled. So it's not faith in a deity, it's not faith in a metaphysical principle, it's not faith in something supernatural, it's not faith in something that, some ancient text that has some great body of wisdom, you know, that somehow you can't quite understand or maybe you haven't even read. But it begins with this amazing, I think amazing statement that in Buddhism we trust our suffering. Now, isn't that an amazing statement? Now, some of you trust your suffering in the wrong way already. So you have to kind of look at it more carefully. So trusting your suffering here is trust your suffering enough, just enough, that you're willing to face it. Just like I was willing to make that phone call today. It was not going to be comfortable, but I didn't shy away from discomfort. I had the phone call. So in the same way, we don't shy away from the way that we suffer, whatever it might be, but we have faith that there's a useful way of addressing it, of meeting it, going into it. So even going into it, rather than bypassing it, rather than running away from it, rather than attacking it, but really going into it, and that we have confidence that that's valuable. And we have hopefully have confidence because we know that there's a practice to be done in that arena of our suffering. The practice is the practice of understanding what we're clinging to, what we're holding on to, what we're resisting, and how clinging and holding on tight and resisting is a form of suffering. So I might be holding on to some self-identity. I might be suffering somehow, and some vague, amorphous suffering. And so I look at it, so why am I feeling so lousy today? I'm feeling lousy because, what's a good reason? Because, it's a good reason for suffering. Because,
I didn't do anything on my to-do list.
You didn't do anything on your to-do list. So if you're suffering around that, in Buddhism we say, okay, if you look at that suffering, what were you clinging to? What were you holding on to?
Productivity
and the value of it. So maybe you're holding on to the idea of productivity, getting something done, and there's plenty of people who are neurotic in our society about getting a lot of things done and being successful and efficient. So that's one area that's certainly interesting to look at and see the values you have associated with productivity. Perhaps there's a sense of self-identity around productivity. If I, you know, the person who does the most during a day is this person who gets the most, you know, that gets the badge. And but then there's also kind of another step to take in, to look at, to kind of get the full terrain. And see, we have to do things in the world, right? It's appropriate to have some to-do list. I have to get up, make breakfast, brush my teeth. Some things we have to do. So it's also useful to look and see, is there something you're clinging to that stands in the way of you being productive, you doing some of those things? And so, you know, there might be something clinging there. It might, you know, so that's something to look at as well. That there's both clinging in the attachment to getting things done, perhaps, but there might also be clinging involved in resisting it. And so these are all kind of areas that we try to look in, try to understand the full range of how we're operating. And the way we sniff it out to find it is by being sensitive to how we feel uncomfortable. And then once we're uncomfortable, we stop and look. Buddhists stop for suffering. It's the bumper sticker, right? Now, it's a lot easier to do that if you have confidence that it's worthwhile to do. If you have no confidence it's worthwhile to do, it can actually be quite depressing. You know, why would you do that? You just, you know, just wallow in my suffering even more? But to have confidence that there's a path through it, maybe not easy path through it, but there's a practice to engage. It's possible to, you know, I'm not stuck with my suffering. And that's one of the articles of faith. If you want a Buddhist creed, tenet that you have to kind of believe in if you do all this, at least helps if you believe it, and that is that suffering is not a static, fixated, rooted, you know, permanent, you know, entity, thing. That suffering is a part of a process, a dynamic process, and it's possible to look into that dynamic process and understand the causes of it, and then have some role in changing those causes in order to help us become freer. So that degree, you have to have faith in that at least, or at least enough, you have to grant it enough, you know, faith in order to kind of start the process. So, and you have to have confidence that it's worthwhile to do it. Then there has to be some application, some effort. And that effort should be persistent. It isn't like, oh, you know, I'll touch into it for a moment and I've done my duty as a Buddhist. But there has to be kind of, okay, let me really do this. Let me kind of look at it really persistently. If it's a meditation practice, for example, there has to be confidence in the value of meditation practice and your ability to do it. And there has to be persistence in doing the meditation practice. You have to make the effort to do it. There's this great, I think it's a great saying that in our seed we say that a meditation or mindfulness, either one, say meditation, actually doesn't work at all unless you do it. So there has to be the willingness to apply oneself, and that's a huge hurdle for some people. I talk to a lot of people who find it a real challenge in their life to find time to meditate because of many, many reasons. Some of them have to do with how busy they are, all the responsibilities they have. Some people because of internal resistance they have to sitting down and facing it. Sometimes because of laziness. Many reasons. So it takes a lot of, you know, it takes some discernment to kind of sort through life and figure out, you know, how to make a life work so you can actually meditate. But one of the qualities that's needed is applying oneself, making the effort. And sometimes it's just a matter of doing it. Just do it. And just kind of, you know, rising to the occasion and then sticking to it. And then there has to be presence. There has to be mindfulness. And that's what we do here, the meditation practice we do. There has to be some ability not to drift off into fantasy and thinking about the past and, you know, how are the Giants going to do today, this year? You know, they're in the play. Will they get in the playoffs? You know. They're kind of, maybe they have the wild card. And this is an important thing to think about. And maybe as soon as this meditation's over, I can go check on the computer how the game is going. And so the whole 40 minutes can go like that, right? There's not much, you know, unless, you know, there's not much presence there. It's so easy to have the mind drift and wander. So mindfulness, the practice of mindfulness is to be present, to be focused, to be here for what's going on. And that's a training we do in Buddhism. And there has to be some confidence that being here and present is a valuable thing to do. And then we learn the skills to be present. We learn what it takes. And part of it just comes from doing it. It's like a muscle. And then there has to be some concentration. Concentration is closely connected to calm. So we have a focused calm where we begin settling down enough and stay focused enough that we can actually see more precisely and more penetratingly what's actually happening here. Have the mind, because an agitated mind can't see very well. The cliche is that you can't see your reflection in a pond that's rippled by the wind. The pond has to be really still in order to see your reflection. Same thing with the mind. If the mind is rippled by all the winds of the mind blowing through, then you can't really see what's here very well. And the function of concentration is to still the mind and focus the mind so there can be some deeper insight in seeing what's going on here in our life. So then in Buddhist practice, in meditation practice, is also then the cultivation of concentration. And then fifth is discernment. So it's one thing to apply oneself. It's one thing to be present. It's one thing to, be still enough to really see deeply. It's something else to begin to be wise about what we see there so we can make choices. What is a wise thing to do here? You're present enough that you see the mind just drifted off into thinking about the Giants, the baseball team. And so instead, you say, this is not really useful. I'm here to really address more fundamental issues in my life than who's going to make it to the playoffs. And so then I think the wise thing to do here is to bring my attention back to the breath, to bring my attention back to the moment. Kind of let go of that. That would be the wise thing to do, perhaps. Or perhaps you find yourself feeling very resistant to being present for the suffering that you have. And so there has to be some discernment, well, I have this resistance, what should I do now? Should I just kind of plunge in any way, in spite of my resistance, into that, be present for my experience, how I'm feeling? Or would it be more useful this moment to bring my attention to the resistance that I have to being present? And so there's a choice made. Is it the resistance or the thing I'm resisting that I should pay attention to and look at? And at different times, different choices are made. Am I really sleepy? Do I need to sit up straighter when I meditate? Do I need to open my eyes when I meditate because I'm so sleepy? That's using discernment, very simple choices we make, looking at what's happening and deciding what to do. One of the very important functions of discernment is to make sure that discernment doesn't agitate us. Because discernment involves a little bit analysis of the situation. And for some people who are familiar with engineering and thinking about every possible thing in their life, they can tie themselves in knots around this discernment thing. Kind of, am I doing it right? How to do it? What should I do? So you have to be discerning enough to watch how you are discerning. So you're discerning. Your discernment is in the service of becoming calm, in the service of helping you become peaceful, in the service of helping you to see, not kind of obscure things even more, not making you more agitated. So in Buddhism, we kind of fine-tune meditation practice. We can fine-tune any activity we do in life by looking at the situation and saying, which of these five faculties is absent? Which of them is needed here? Which one needs to be tuned up, perhaps? Which of them might be too strong? And so they say that the faith needs to be balanced with discernment, which is a beautiful thing, I think, because there's often this idea of blind faith. And Buddhism, there's no expectation for blind faith, but rather, and faith is supposed to be balanced or be in cooperation with our capacity to see clearly, to be discerning, to be wise. We're using our intelligence to really kind of look and see what's going on here. And sometimes if you rely too much on faith, then practice can go askew. If you rely too much on your intelligence and thinking about things, then maybe you don't relax enough. Faith helps us relax, so it's easier to go into it. I've known people who've relied on faith too much in Buddhism, their faith, some kind of faith. I remember there was one woman who said, was really got kind of bitter about her Buddhist practice after many years. because she said, I thought that if I just sat on the cushion and did my time, that, you know, like magical thinking, it would just happen to me, whatever was supposed to happen. So she just sat there. She was very patient, I guess, and waited for something to happen. She had faith, lots of faith. But there was no effort, there was no discernment, no mindfulness, no concentration. She just sat there. So that, you know, excessive faith, perhaps. And then I have to make more effort here. Maybe I'm sleepy. Maybe I'm complacent. Maybe I'm lazy. Or do I need to make less effort? Some people make too much effort. They try too hard. They take this Buddhism way too seriously. And so you need to lighten up and kind of back off a little bit and relax. And that's part of the function. So they say that concentration is in balance, should be in balance with effort. And concentration, remember, is closely connected to being calm. So sometimes effort is too much, and we need to bring in more calm, more concentration. Sometimes concentration is too much, we're too calm, and we have to bring in more effort. If you're too calm, you fall asleep. And so you have to watch as you meditate, you know, am I getting too kind of relaxed here and just start, you know, things are so good, yeah, I'm a good Buddhist, this is wonderful, I love this, this is really great, I should go tell my neighbors and my friend, and we should tell them to come down to the local retreat center, and you know, this is really wonderful, and if they only knew how wonderful it is to be really present and attentive and really be with your breath, you know, then they would just be so happy, and you know, I should really show them the way, and you know, oops, where was I the last 10 minutes? And so if you get too calm, sometimes the mind will drift off. And so sometimes you have to tighten it up by energizing the practice a little more to bring more alertness and aliveness to it. And then it said that mindfulness itself, which sits in the middle, so there's two ends, there's faith and discernment, and then inside of those there's effort and concentration. And then the center of the five is mindfulness. And it said that mindfulness never needs to be balanced with anything else. And that you can never have too much mindfulness. So you can, in fact, it says that mindfulness is the kind of the great balancer. And when the other four get imbalanced, if you rely on your mindfulness and really try to be mindful, just the fact of being present in a careful way, really just simply seeing what's here, that itself tends to bring things into balance in the way they need to be. And it's a remarkable thing to have these five capacities, we say five faculties, activated, because when they get activated well, then Buddhism has another list for you. And it's not just the five faculties, there's also the five powers. And the five powers are faith, effort, mindfulness, concentration, and discernment. The faculties are more like the potentials we have. We have these capacities, these potentials. And when the potentials are developed, then they become, the Buddhist word is power. And some Buddhists are a little bit afraid of the word power. There's kind of, at least in our circle, sometimes a sense of you're supposed to be calm and kind and gentle and what else, you know? You know, humble and self-effacing, and, you know, I don't know. And sometimes people err a little bit too much in that direction. And here we have this word power. You know, and there's something that happens as practice gets stronger for people, as people get into the practice and develop these capacities, they become powers that we carry with us. And to carry these powers with us into our lives is a great help, great support for how we, you know, for just life in general. So one of the places to develop these five faculties, a wonderful place to develop them, is actually in meditation practice itself. And one of the consequences of that is that as they're developed there, they can be transferred and applied also in our regular life. Our capacity to, all these capacities then are more available. But in particular, things like mindfulness and concentration and discernment, that we can be more mindful, more discerning, and calmer as we go about our life. And it's great to have mindfulness be a power. It's great to have discernment, our wisdom, our capacity to be intelligent, to be a power that's ready to use and help us sort through the maze of our suffering, the great, you know, and the puzzle of suffering. So we can follow, go through the maze and find the causes of it, and even better, begin to let go of the cause and live with an open heart. So those are my thoughts. We have 5 minutes, and it's not much time, but perhaps we can have one or two questions if it seems relevant. Make some about this topic, if you'd like.
I was just struck by the Tibetan Buddhist words around faith and how they have these eight water bowls or eight bowls in front of their figures that they meditate before, and the fifth one is the bowl of faith, and you don't develop faith until you've drank of the water of enlightenment and come to believe in it and seen the fire. There's a candle, that's one of them. But faith, in other words, is something that comes as a result of our own experience of what has happened, and so therefore we know that we can depend on I might have misspoke myself on the enlightenment, excuse me, but faith is something that builds from our experience as opposed to leaving your faith at the door and coming in and just blindly believing something.
Yeah, so I believe that. So that's good. Also, confidence, if you use the word confidence rather than faith, people ask, how do I get confident? How do I develop confidence? And my favorite answer is in small steps. Practice, but small, even some small steps, you know, to look at, you know, enlightenment, to look at, you know, there's so many great goals you can have in life, especially in Buddhist practice, but to, you know, to see the mountain to climb, it seems impossible. But if you have confidence, if you develop confidence, you can take the next step. With enough steps, you'll go quite far. And then eventually, something you said, Abraham, about, you know, have faith in enlightenment, whatever. They say that when you're fully enlightened, you become a person of no faith because you don't need it anymore in that regard. You don't need that faith in the possibility of freedom because you're free. So one more.
I've been thinking a lot lately about negative mind states, since the negative spinning of the mind, interpretations of the day's events, and it really does feel like there is a faith in that way of thinking. It's a very it's weird, very, very strange. And I mean, I understand that the first step is awareness of it, but I was wondering if you could just talk a little bit more about faith in old patterns and old paths.
Talk about it. It's just amazing, isn't it? It's kind of awesome that how much effort and energy and time can go into the same repetitive activity, same repetitive thinking. You know, I mean, how many times, you know, do we review the conversation, the event, from every possible angle, and what we said, and they said, and they, you know, it's amazing what the mind can do. It has a tremendous capacity to, it has a lot of faith that somehow that's useful to do. And, you know, and as I've talked about here sometimes, I used to have a lot of faith in the value of planning my future. You know, all the details, you know, the thinking ahead and what I was going to say when I saw that person and, you know, what was going to happen and what I would do and all that. And what helped me with that, give up that faith, that confidence in planning ahead and reviewing every possible contingency, was I would plan, I'd have a good plan for the future, and the future would come, and the future didn't look anything like my plan. And, you know, it happened enough. Maybe that had to happen 10,000 times. I don't know how often it happened. But I'm a slow learner. But eventually, it happened enough that I said, wait a minute, Gil. You know, your track record in being able to plan what the future is going to be is pretty poor. So then I thought, you know, I think I'll give this. I think, you know, I'll lighten up. I'll loosen up on this. You know, and maybe it's okay not to. Since my capacity to anticipate the future is so poor, perhaps I'll kind of, you know, not fixate so much. Not, you know, be so preoccupied about that particular activity. I mean, sometimes we have to plan ahead, but you know, it can be overly done. So these five faculties are useful things. It's useful to memorize this list because they kind of represents the grammar of meditation and the kind of the very foundation of meditation. The particular inner skills or capacities that get activated and come into play, and so it's how these grammatical parts or these elements of the syntax or whatever of meditation, that how they work together, and that helps with unfolding of meditation practice and everything else in our life. So thank you so much. I hope you find some good things to have faith in.